The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda and is intended for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only.
A lot of entertainment.
Please consult with professionals before making healthcare decisions.
Hello, today is June 15th, 2020. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And you are listening to the Bloodstream Podcast.
See cocaine somewhere or think about cocaine, have that part of their brain activated. And then even though the part of them, which is the executive, the whole them, is saying, no, don't do it. There's all these reasons not to do it. It loses that battle.
That voice belongs to Dr. Jason Schiffman, the primary investigator of UCLA's Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior and the director of its dual diagnosis program. He joins me for today's interview. Later in the episode, we'll look at the latest when it comes to COVID, discuss developments in telehealth, and address the civil unrest and peaceful protests that have sprung out of George Floyd's murder. But first, Natalie, as we enter into the fourth month of stay-at-home, WTF is going on with the world, what do you find yourself thinking about as we're coming into recording today?
I mean, things are starting to open back up, but here in LA, mostly people are staying home. We haven't seen our friends yet. I attend a weekly support group. That's still virtual. My therapy is still virtual.
Yep.
I'm doing help for prenatal and postpartum expectant families virtually.
Yep. It's virtual everything time.
It is virtual everything time.
Actually, as this is out on June 15th, the WFH is, it's no longer the World Congress because that was canceled. I think it's their virtual summit is what it's called, but it's going on right now. It's June 14th through 19th, the World Federation of Hemophilia. If you're interested in participating in that, there's also the virtual Bleeding Disorders Conference, August 1st through 8th, and the virtual HFA Symposium, August 24th through 29th. So it really is virtual everything everywhere you look.
It's true.
On next month's episode, we will preview the Believe Limited Bloodstream-related programs going on at the BDC. But for now, there are links in the program notes if you want to click on any one of those to register or learn more about those conferences. Would you say, Natalie, have you learned anything about these virtual everythings, both as a participant and as a facilitator, that teaches you something for when things are back to some version of normal? Have you learned any? Are you going to want to do some things virtually going forward either way?
I mean, So I've learned what I miss about in-person stuff by not having it.
What's that?
I miss physical touch. Miss touching the humans that I'm interacting with virtually, and how much that is important to me to feel connected to people.
Mm.
Because I'm not having it right now.
Right.
But what I have learned is that you can still continue doing the stuff even without being in person, and it's just as valuable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's funny. Some of the ways that Breaking Through has adapted, like we would never choose to do a theater program virtually. Like that wasn't a thing you would even have as an option a couple of months ago. But it's been really interesting building the rapport with this cast, not over this really special truncated 3-day weekend, but over months and months of weekly touch points and check-ins and master classes and seminars and now rehearsals. And it's a really different experience, but I wouldn't say it's any weaker, or it's not less than what the live would have been. So it's sort of interesting to think about, well, if we went this way, it might open it up to even more people, because now we could do this with people from anywhere around the world.
True. It opens it up that way. I mean, I think about the support group I attend, and what's cool about it is I think more people are coming more consistently because getting there
isn't
a part of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I may decide I can't go next Monday because I have a thing that butts up to it, and I wouldn't be able to make it the drive in LA.
Right.
The hour it would take at 6 p.m. to get there.
Right.
So I don't sign up. But now,
because it's a 3-hour experience as opposed to a 1-hour experience.
Yeah. And now it's truly just a 1-hour experience. So that is definitely a benefit.
Yeah. That's a huge, huge upside to the virtual everything. Well, Natalie, I hate to move us on, but we got a lot to get to, and it is now time for one of our favorite segments here at the Bloodstream Podcast.
The Like segment.
It has arrived once again, made possible by Genentech. The hemophilia community is a tight-knit family, did you know that? And especially during these challenging times, it can be helpful to connect with that community for discussion and support on social media. We were just talking about this. That's why we wanted to tell you about Genentech's Facebook community for people with hemophilia A. Meet and connect with community members like you and learn about a treatment option for hemophilia A. You can visit their Facebook page by searching hemafacebook.com or by clicking on the link in the program notes. Natalie?
Yes.
You seem concerned.
Well, right now I have
what's going on?
Our dog Russell.
Oh, yeah. What's he up to?
Well, I'm supporting him with my entire back, his entire weight, as he grooms himself.
Uh-huh.
Very, very intensely. And yeah, as soon as I moved out of the way, he tumbled down. So he was just letting me support him while he went to town on himself.
Oh, Russell Sprouts.
Such a weirdo. But yeah, on to the like segment.
So what do we got? Something about telehealth this month.
So yeah, speaking of virtual things, it's key strategies for remote chronic disease management. So super okay. applies to our community. And as patients continue to avoid in-person care, providers need to pivot and provide remote chronic disease management to drive.
I just have to get a picture of Natalie trying to focus on this segment while the dog's licking himself, sitting on her lap, computer and notebook open. What a pro. You're just going right through it, but it's happening. So
I'm trying. He's, yeah, it's comfort and trust.
Oh, there we go. Even better.
Now I'm getting groomed.
Great. This is really what people want. Well, we'll put this up on the Facebook page, though, so you can see what we're dealing with.
I think this is really the content people want.
This is the interesting thing. But I'm sorry, I interrupted.
So patients continue to avoid in-person care, and providers need to pivot to remote chronic disease management to drive positive health outcomes.
As a result of COVID.
Yes. Yeah. So COVID caused primary care clinics to focus on the pandemic and shutter their doors for non-urgent care.
Right.
Most chronically ill patients... Oh my gosh, this dog. Sorry.
He loves the like segment as much as we do. That's what I've come to learn.
Yeah, he's really my pal lately, just following me around. Okay, so what I was saying was the population of chronically ill patients oftentimes are immunocompromised.
Yeah.
And have a greater risk of contracting a more serious or fatal form of not fatal form, but it affecting
has more fatal implications.
Exactly,
for them. Yeah.
On their system. So they've social distanced, and this has also included avoiding healthcare access. So the math here is they avoid the care, chronic illness worsens, they end up in the ER, the exact place they're trying to avoid.
Mm.
21%, this article cites that 21% of chronically ill patients are worried about maintaining healthcare while COVID is
maintaining
around.
Healthcare coverage?
No, maintaining
just wellness?
Wellness.
Okay.
And then 53% are worried about visiting a healthcare facility for something that's not COVID related.
Yeah, I mean.
And these are this article just came out. These are still concerns even as things still open up.
Right.
We've started to flatten the curve, but this isn't going anywhere.
I mean, I just saw a thing today. We're recording this, as always, a few days ahead. So it's Wednesday. What's today? Wednesday the 9th or 10th, something like that, ahead of the Monday. But I saw something today that we've just crossed 2 million cases here in the U.S., and there's upticks in 20 states. So it hasn't gone anywhere while our attention has perhaps drifted.
No, and so how can we look at chronic disease management a little bit differently? So this article states three ways: remote patient monitoring, secure direct messages, and telehealth tools.
Hmm.
So remote patient monitoring with tools like glucose monitors or Bluetooth-enabled blood pressure cuffs.
Hmm.
And what that does is if it's Bluetooth-enabled, it automatically sends the information, and then if a pattern changes or something's really out of whack in your normal, I guess that would be a pattern change, it would alert your physician.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's also just regular cuffs that you could do and then input that, but that's a little bit more laborious than the Bluetooth enabled.
Automated.
So the downside of remote patient monitoring technology is expense. Not all clinics, not all primary care facilities have this, and these things aren't necessarily being covered yet. So,
right, okay.
But that's one thing. Another thing is secure direct messaging. And what this does is it drives down patient call centers.
We've used that for years with different providers.
Oh my gosh.
Loved it.
I love it. And what it allows for is frequent but low acuity check-ins. So, you know,
frequent but low acuity. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. And sometimes I think a lot with direct messaging is managing anxiety around managing your chronic illness. So I don't have a chronic illness, but I do. I mean, I have chronic pain in my back, and and I am in regular touch with a lot of my healthcare team, and just sending a little message of being like, this is kind of funny. Is this worth a telehealth call? Is this worth coming in?
Yeah.
And maybe getting more information from the provider to just kind of quell my nerves a bit. You know, I love it. I mean, I might be one of those annoying patients who use it a lot and they're like, oh, another direct message from Natalie.
Yeah, but like, isn't that better than another appointment from Natalie?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And then the third one is telehealth tools. So, a lot of the visits that were happening in person are now happening via, you know, medical Zoom type technology.
Right.
Providers and payers have had to figure out reimbursement around this, and that's different than in person.
Sure.
But this has seen a huge spike since COVID, and is really time efficient, and for most things can do what an in-person visit can do.
And that is a complicated thing you just said, right? Because the ramifications of like learning that we have these digital and remote and virtual tools and technology that can help us during this time of necessity, it's also going to teach us what we don't necessarily have to go back to. And that is going to eliminate jobs. And that is going to change costs. And that is going to change protocol and procedures. There's going to be a lot of, in my opinion, there's going to be a lot of discomfort that comes with the good things we learn as a result of this time when it comes to healthcare.
I mean, discomfort always comes when growth occurs. So, you know, we're learning. I think we're learning that in micro and macro ways in our society right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what else this article talked about was with these key strategies for remote chronic disease management, in order for them to work, healthcare centers have to promote digital health literacy.
Digital health literacy. Okay.
Yes. And the three keys to digital health literacy are to A, know it exists.
Sure.
B, how to use the tech.
I would agree.
And
wait, can we just pause? Is that not the first two keys to literacy of any kind? One, be aware of the thing that you want to be literate in, that it exists. Number two, become an expert in it. Like, so what's the one that's maybe unique to this?
I mean, see the value and be motivated to use it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hardest one, right?
Yes, 100%. Because
you know? If you don't see the value and you're not motivated, you're not going to become literate.
You won't become literate. Also, you know, you mentioned the Bluetooth thing earlier and the automated nature of that and how convenient that is. I think it's also very important as we are quickly putting things into practice. Are patients and end users being meaningfully brought in on the design and implementation of these things? Because if not, I can almost guarantee you it will not be used as often or as effectively as it could be otherwise. Too often, great ideas are just executed by those that had them and not necessarily with the input of anyone who it's intended to benefit, right? So like you don't actually get meaningful input on the end user experience.
Totally. And I also think, I mean, a lot of times this is for adults, but I do know certain adults, nudge, nudge, who love badges and stuff. So making the
Russell,
app...
Are you nudging Russell?
Yeah, I was nudging Russell. He loves badges and accolades. but if you create some kind of a fun system that if you sync six times in a week or...
Gamify it.
You know, yeah, gamify it. Make it fun. Make it flashy. Make it interesting. People will engage with it more. Monetize it. Have some kind of... If you... input the data or sync the data X amount of X percentage a month or a year, you get some kind of reimbursement or some kind of...
I don't know why that's not done more. I know there's certain health plans and companies where it's like if you go to the gym, you get money back, or if you buy a salad, somebody gives you a high five or whatever it is. I know there's like things implemented to sort of do what you're talking about, but I've always thought that should be done at such a higher rate. I mean, if I was an insurance company, I would love to know if the people who were on my plan were taking good care of themselves. And if they were, I'd be inclined to want to incentivize that. But I don't know. There's a lot of things that don't make sense to me.
Yeah. And one interesting thing is there was a study in 2016, and granted that was 4 years ago, that said that only, now I can't tell if I wrote 16 or 18 down.
Okay.
So it's 16 or 18, same range, percent digital literacy.
That's
among all, patients.
Oh, that's,
you know,
very low.
So I think in the last 4 years, a lot has changed. I'm sure if they did that study
true.
Again now, people who had never used a telehealth platform before probably have.
Right.
And especially in the last 4 months.
Yeah.
But basically, this article was kind of like, if you're a clinic and you're not behind telehealth, direct messaging, or remote patient monitoring, after this COVID pandemic, you might lose a lot of, basically get with it, with the times.
That goes to what we were just talking about with discomfort and having to implement practices. I mean, insurance companies and others are going to say, okay, this is how we now do this. And if you're not adapting with times, I mean, what's the, this is a harsh expression, but what is it? Adapt or die?
Like, I think so.
You know, that's...
Evolve or die, right?
Evolve or die, right.
Is that it?
I think it is, yeah. If it's not, we're just... We'll, you know, they're both... We can use words however we want. We'll say evolve or die. There's also a line in... what's it called? It's the vampire... Not vampire. Who am I? Zombies, World War Z, Max... Oh, I can see his dad. Brooks. Max Brooks. There's a line in there that I love, which is, movement is life. Movement
that's cool.
is life. Anything else from the article that we should be aware of, Natalie, as we're wrapping up the like here?
No. So it was put out by patientengagementhit.com, and we'll have the article in the program notes. It's Key Strategies for Remote Chronic Disease Management. And if you want to read the whole thing, it'll be available. But I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. Interesting, timely, appropriate for us and our audience, and made possible today by Genentech. So thank you, Genentech, for making the like segment possible. We want to remind you again to check out their Facebook page by clicking the link in the program notes or by visiting hemefacebook.com. Hey, did you know that the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda, without whom this episode would not be possible?
I did know that.
You did know that?
Yeah.
I'm proud of you. You're listening. did you know you can go to bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about Takeda and the resources that they've made available for the bleeding disorders community, including their response to COVID-19? Did you know that?
What's the website?
Bleedingdisorders.com. Do you need a pen?
No, I got one. Thank you.
Oh, you got a pen?
I do.
Did you have to use it to write bleedingdisorders.com?
No, it's easy. I remembered it. Thanks, Takeda.
So we just mentioned Takeda's response to COVID. COVID hasn't gone away. And in the last few weeks, there have been other news stories that have captured attention. And I think, too, we've all just kind of gotten, to some degree or another, sick and frustrated and tired. And people are assessing risks in new ways. And how many times can media cover the same story? But it's still out there. And as we just talked about, it's actually on the rise in some places. So... The good news, I guess, is that there isn't anything banner-worthy to tell you about COVID when it comes to bleeding disorders, but there are still a lot of unknowns, and there are unknowns, and they're learning more, it seems, about COVID's impact on the bleeding and clotting systems of the body, and that does affect us. So continue to pay attention to credible sources. I mean, most notably and obviously, the National Hemophilia Foundation and the Hemophilia Federation of America. They've been very communicative through this time. NHF is continuing to produce webinars with updates on COVID. I think the most recent at the time that we are recording anyway is one that is specific to COVID and inhibitor management. So if you're interested in kind of keeping up, follow along with NHF and HFA, links in the program notes. Specifically though, I do want to make you aware of something that I didn't know about until I was actually preparing for this episode. And I have a rule of thumb. If I'm not aware of something until I start digging around real thoughtfully, probably most people aren't. So there are different COVID-related assistance, financial assistance programs that you should be made aware of. There are four that are listed on NHF's website. I won't run through all the names and specifics, but there's four different ones that are listed on NHF's website. And there's one that I believe HFA themselves are the administer of that you can not only apply for, but you can also donate to it or refer a family to it. And I love that feature. So if you know of a family that is hurting right now because of COVID in some way or another, take a look at what hemophiliafed.org, take a look at what they have available in their COVID relief fund. And if you think that family might be appropriate for it, refer them. Sometimes, you know, our own pride can get in the way of asking for the help we need. So if you've got a friend that you know could use that kind of help, don't be afraid to be a good friend. There'll be links in the program notes, but both on HFA and NHF's websites, you can find these if you click around. They're COVID relief funds. So that's my only COVID update. That's really the only thing of note to mention. And just again, stay connected to your credible sources. All right, we've got the interview with Dr. Schiffman coming up in just a little bit. We like him a lot. You know Dr. Schiffman as well.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. He's a good speaker.
He's funny.
He's an expert on his topic. But we have one more segment to get to, and that is this one on race, on racism, and the general response nationwide to George Floyd's death. It's now been, two weeks and a half. Time is just gets weirder with every passing week in 2020, but some time has gone by. We talked about it on Friday in a live that Amar from the Cheat Codes podcast and I co-hosted with Philip Okwo and Andre Marcel Harris. Great conversation from those two sickle cell advocates. You can find that on the Facebook page for Bloodstream Media. We also released it Monday as an audio-only episode. So if you're a subscriber, you probably heard it. If you're not a subscriber, that's on you. But Natalie, we haven't heard from you since this all started. So as a way of getting into the segment, I would just be curious for you to share with me, share with our audience, where is your head and heart at when it comes to race at the moment?
I mean, my head and heart is where my head and heart normally is, in maternal health and the race discrepancies in maternal health between Black women and white women, and that Black women are much more likely to have mortalities and morbidities in labor and pregnancy and postpartum than white women by a lot. And so, you know, that pulls on my heart. And then it just brings it back to general health discrepancies between Black people and white people. And when I was doing a little digging around, I found this organization called White Coats for Black Lives, which I thought was really cool. I had never really heard of them, but they...
White coats as in things you wear, or codes like computer?
White coats as in like medical professionals.
Got it.
Yeah. So they, there a lot of them are out protesting right now. And a lot of them, due to COVID and due to the hours, aren't out protesting, but they're doing other things to support it. But I went on the website, and there's three key parts to their mission: to foster critical dialogue, to end racial inequality, and to prepare future physicians. Mm. So in the fostering critical dialogue, it's to encourage healthcare providers, health organizations, and medical institutions to publicly recognize racism as a public health issue. And I love that too. And what I think is cool about that is what I do know about when a woman's carrying a child and undergoes stress, certain genes can be turned on or turned off in the DNA of the fetus.
Because of stress to the pregnant mother.
Yeah. So stressors for Black women tend to be higher because of systematic racism. And so before a Black baby's even born, they essentially have experienced racism. And that's so intense to think about.
Yeah.
One thing that was really, really interesting and really shook me today, I was looking, a client who's pregnant, had sent me babynames.com. And so I was looking just on babynames.com. And when you open babynames.com right now, there's a list of names of people who have been killed, Black people who have been killed by police. And it said, this is a list. This list is all someone's babies. So pregnant people and expectant families who are going to babynames.com to look for their baby names, open up that page right now.
And good on you, baby names.
A giant list that said, these are all someone's babies.
That's strong.
Yeah, really, really impactful. So White Coats for Black Lives Matter, they also want to prepare future physicians. So they're improving the recruitment and support of Black, Latinx, and Native American health professional students. And so, you know, right now, those numbers are significantly lower than white people in the medical field. So in order to improve outcomes, you have to have more representation in the system itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could go on and on. I feel like there's so much, especially in maternal health. But that's what's sitting with me right now. You know, feel free to drop a mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com and we could chat some more. But there really just is the discrepancies in care that translate to the bleeding disorders community, and, you know, both in hemophilia and in sickle cell, where pain is a big point of the experience.
You uncovered some real unfortunate stuff about that too as we were preparing for this.
Yeah, so there in 2016 there was a study that went that showed that healthcare providers still more healthcare providers than not believe carry the bias that Black people don't experience pain in the same way white people do, experience less. So the treatment for someone who shows up at the ER in pain will be very different for a Black person than a white person.
And I just can't believe in my humanness that if you've got the, well, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be so shocked. I just think if you're intelligent enough to be a doctor, you're intelligent enough to recognize that systemic racism is a problem. So if you or someone on your staff or actually believe that someone of a different race just by virtue of the race has a different experience of pain, if the first move isn't to look inward, to analyze why that's your belief, then you're making the wrong move. But I guess we have lots of smart people who, unfortunately, being smart doesn't exclude you from being racist or misogynist or xenophobic or any number of other horrifically inhuman characteristics. Just to support what you were saying about maternal health, I have some stats up from DoSomething.org. These are aggregated from different places by DoSomething.org. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to experience a pregnancy-related death than white women, even at similar levels of income and education. Mm-hmm. Black Americans are more likely than white Americans to be arrested. Once arrested, they're more likely to be convicted. Once convicted, they're more likely to experience lengthy prison sentences. Black Americans and white Americans use drugs at the same rate, but Black Americans are 6 times more likely to be arrested for it. On average, Black men in the U.S. receive sentences that are 19.1% longer than those of white men convicted for the same crimes. In the U.S., Black individuals are twice as likely to be unemployed than white individuals. Once employed, Black individuals earn nearly 25% less than their white counterparts. So we talk about the gender gap, which is a real thing, but also worth talking about the racial gap when it comes to pay equity. Just 2 more pieces of data here. One U.S. study found that job resumes with traditionally white-sounding names received 50% more callbacks than those with traditionally Black names. And in the U.S., Black workers are less likely than white workers to be employed in a job that is consistent with their level of education. So I guess if we could land this somewhere, I'd want to land on, I think most Black people probably feel this, if not know this, but not all white people feel this. No white people feel this, and not all white people know this or behave as though it's true. When you hear the discrepancies across education, criminal justice, health, at what point is it just too widespread to be anything other than rampantly systemic? And that's a hard thing to admit and have to do something about. That's why we haven't for 400 years, but we have to at least be willing to accept that it's true. The denial has to stop, because without that, there's no hope for progress. So if, like me, you were born white, then I would recommend, if you're looking for a place that you can put your energy, if you would like to be more active, there's a lot of ways you can do it, but I'm going to point to a group called Showing Up for Racial Justice. Their website is showingupforracialjustice.org. They are made up of white people who are interested in accountable action to support racial justice and human rights for all. They're a great organization, and it really is about how to be the right kind of ally, doing things that matter as consistently as possible. So that's all. Thanks, Natalie. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. Thank you all for listening. And with that, let's go on to the conversation with Dr. Jason Schiffman. I am joined now by psychiatrist and the director of UCLA's dual diagnosis program, Dr. Jason Schiffman. Hello, Dr. Schiffman, and welcome to Bloodstream.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So before diving in, for background, I want to share with listeners this brief bio on you that was published in Psychology Today. Dr. Jason Schiffman is the director of the UCLA Dual Diagnosis Program. He is also the primary investigator at the UCLA
Semmel Institute, yeah.
Semmel Institute. The Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior, where he is engaged in translational research investigating new compounds for the treatment of schizophrenia, mood disorders, and addiction. He completed his residency in psychiatry at UCLA and is a graduate of the MD-MBA program at the University of Southern California, where he focused on health systems management and web-based healthcare delivery. He has extensive research experience in molecular biology and is the author of numerous scientific publications in this field. Dr. Schiffman also received a Master's of Arts degree in linguistics from UCLA, where he specialized in syntax and semantics. One of Dr. Schiffman's primary interests has been the development of novel psychopharmacologic and psychotherapeutic interventions to treat co-occurring addictive and anxiety disorders. As director of the UCLA Dual Diagnosis Program, he's developed a treatment approach that addresses both the addictive process as well as associated anxiety or mood disorders, promoting recovery from both simultaneously. Most importantly, to start us off, one fan to another, how have you coped in quarantine without the MBA, and how excited are you for its return?
Well, let's start with the second question first. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you know something I don't, but my understanding is it's still pretty up in the air as far as when it will return.
The when is, yeah, yes. But I think the if, it seems like it's a yes, but when, I think.
Yeah. So I think probably because I don't want to get my hopes up. I probably haven't been following that too closely. So, interestingly, I've been forced to do probably more healthy things, such as go out for walks and stuff, as opposed to going to NBA, going to Clippers games and watching games on TV. But I did just recently binge watch the Last Dance documentary on Michael Jordan. So that's kind of substituted a little bit.
I hear you. Yeah, that was a good 5-week itch scratcher for me. Yeah. To a Sunday for 5 weeks. It was like my own little therapeutic regimen for NBA withdrawal.
Yeah.
So to dive in, dual diagnosis, what exactly is a dual diagnosis program, and why did you start the one at UCLA? What need did you see yourself addressing?
Sure. So so dual diagnosis actually is used in mental health care in two separate, with two separate meanings, or within two separate sort of subspecialties. One is for when somebody has an eating disorder and then a co-occurring psychiatric condition. And the other is when somebody has an addictive disorder and then another co-occurring psychiatric condition. So the latter case is the part of the field that I'm involved in. So we're treating people that have co-occurring addictive disorders and other psychiatric conditions. That's what dual diagnosis means. I think it's an interesting fact that we have this term because it implies that somehow the norm would be monodiagnosis, right? Meaning with addiction. And I do think that to some degree that used to be what the prevailing view was within the treatment industry or within the field of addiction treatment. I think that is shifting. My personal view has always been that really monodiagnosis when it comes to addiction is non-existent, right? So meaning I think that without exception, addiction is always a solution that becomes its own problem. And the solution for which addiction originally served as, I'm sorry, the problem for which addiction originally served as a solution is the other condition in the dual of dual diagnosis. And, you know, that may be a depressive disorder, an anxiety disorder, another type of mood disorder, such as bipolar disorder, et cetera. But I to date have treated quite a few people with addiction and so far have never met anybody who didn't at least have, you know, some form of depression or anxiety as associated, you know, as a co-occurring condition. So.
So how do your points of view on this, though, differ maybe from some of your colleagues, or in so much as there is consensus in the mental health profession, perhaps is there deviation from the consensus point of view? And I guess that kind of gets back to the question of why did you have to start this? Why maybe isn't this more common?
So that's a great question. You know, like most younger fields, there is quite a bit of sort of acrimony and disagreement within the treatment, the addiction treatment field. Historically, that disagreement really, the two camps were the 12-step camp and then the psychiatry camp, right? And that was, those were the two groups that sort of would attack one another. Now, as the field has progressed, there's more material for people to disagree about. I would say though, that there's probably progressively less disagreement. I don't want to get too far down that path because it'll take me away from the original question that you asked about sort of why, you know, why did I start the program? Why? So the answer is, so I'm in recovery myself. You know, originally got sober prior to going to medical school. I did have a relapse, so my second sobriety date, which is my current one, is, was the first day of my second year of medical school. But in any case, when I went to do my residency in psychiatry, I knew that I was interested in working in the addiction field. And at that point at UCLA in the residency program there, the option was to work in the addiction medicine clinic. And that was a medication management only clinic, which meant that, you know, patients who were treated there were assessed for medications to help them with their addiction. And then to the extent that there was any other facet of their recovery addressed, it was really sort of peripheral in that there was a social worker that was attached to the clinic, and you would send the patient to go speak with the social worker after the meeting with the doctor, and then the social worker would figure out what other additional resources the patient could be referred to. And as somebody in recovery myself at the time, I just knew that while medications were absolutely a important and sometimes crucial component of a patient's treatment, they were by no means sufficient. So meaning I knew that nobody who was only having their addiction treated just with medications had any chance of really actually recovering. So I saw that there was a need there. And, you know, this was now in 2012. Things are a little bit different now, but I was able, fortunately, to convince the powers that be at UCLA during my fourth year of residency to let me start the dual diagnosis program there, convince them of the need that, look, you know, for this patient population, having an integrated program that provided not only medication management, but also psychotherapy and case management, et cetera, was going to be really important and necessary in order to provide sort of the minimally acceptable level of care for these patients.
And what do you hear from these patients when they, because I imagine in many cases, people are not coming to the dual diagnosis program as their first means of intervention or their first therapeutic endeavor. I imagine people have tried at least some other form of trying to either bring some amount of harm reduction or get off of the substance or whatever it may be. What do people tell you they're finding from the program that makes it particularly valuable?
Right. So, I mean, listen, nobody presents to treatment unless there's a crisis, right? So it's sufficiently expensive and inconvenient that people only really present for treatment when there's been some sort of recent acute crisis that's happened. Sometimes for people who enter the program, you know, it was their first crisis, you know, related to their substance use, but you're right in asking, you know, most patients, it's not their first attempt at getting sober. Or treating their addiction. either on their own or through having tried other modalities. So whether that be 12-step or other community-based approaches, or having just tried to work through it with an outpatient therapist, or having been to residential treatment of various types. What I would say is unique about the UCLA dual diagnosis program is that, and it was more unique at the time that I started it, maybe less unique now in 2020, is that we really take the approach that what I can again conceive to be the underlying mental health condition is inextricably intertwined with the addictive process, and that you can't actually treat one without also addressing the other. And that to do so really sets patients up for failure. That at the time was definitely, I think, counter to the prevailing idea, which was that particularly on the mental health care side, which was that, well, you know, you don't touch the mental health side until you have the addiction. You just treat the addiction first. And primarily what that meant was really 12-step based approaches. You know, and then once people have their sobriety together, then you go and you start addressing the mental health component. There's a kernel of wisdom to that, which is that, you know, you don't take somebody who's 4 days off of heroin and start going into their childhood sexual trauma if they have it, right? You know, that's not, you know, you don't want to really be destabilizing people at a time when they really need stability and are vulnerable to relapse. At the same time, for most of us with an addiction history, the primary triggers for relapse and for cravings are emotional distress. They're not the only triggers, right? So you can have purely environmental cues, right? So, you know, I'm a recovered heroin addict, right? So if I, you know, I think the thing I noticed when I got sober is, you know, mango chutney tends to smell like black tar heroin. So, you know, especially in my early days of recovery, you know, if I would smell mango chutney, it would be a triggering event for me without there being necessarily an emotional distress tied to it. However, a huge, and again, maybe even primary source of triggers for addicts to enter into the craving state, which is what leads to relapse for people who otherwise are trying to stay sober. The primary category of triggers are these emotional triggers that are related to anxiety and depression and the sense of self, usually shame-based sense of self that underlie them. And so to not address those, simultaneously with addressing the issues related to just the addiction piece, I think is one of the reasons why historically there's been such terrible outcomes for addiction treatment. And I think that when you start to really recognize, again, that addiction is a problem unto itself and yet inextricably tied to the emotional or psychological problems for which it was originally a solution. When you recognize that and recognize that in order for people to really get better, you have to address these things simultaneously, you really do get much better results.
What's the number one thing that people misunderstand about addicts?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that I think is you hear a lot about addicts is that they're manipulative, which is true. But when you hear that, I think that it is said as usually a statement about their character, like meaning that the, you know, that manipulative people who are manipulative by nature are the people that become addicts. And I think the causality is actually the other way around. I don't think that there's anything about the character of people who become addicts that's any more or less manipulative than the general population. For multiple reasons, is that once somebody has developed an addiction, they do behave in ways that are experienced as being very manipulative by the people that they have relationships with. And sometimes it is them being manipulative consciously, or, you know, with meaning, you know, it's in the service of their addiction. They have to lie in order to conceal their use, or, you know, they have to manipulate their doctor into giving them medications that they want, you know, or, you know, they have to, you know, lie to their family members in order to, again, you know, cover up things that they're doing in order to covertly use. But I think a lot of that type of manipulation is mostly due to the fact that for understandable and I think good reasons, we've made substance use not an acceptable thing to do. And so when you, anytime you make substance use not an acceptable thing to do, or anything and not acceptable thing to do, somebody who does it is going to have to be manipulative if they're going to do it. The other thing that I think, and this is maybe more important to the core of your question about maybe ways in which addicts are misunderstood, is, you know, addicts will, for example, tell you, I promise you I'm never going to use again. And then literally, you know, sometimes the next hour go and use. And that is experienced, understandably, by the person who was told by the addict that they were never going to use again as being very manipulative. And I think what is probably not understood by people who don't have an addiction is that the addict, when they tell you they're never going to use again, often believes that that's the case, really means it. They're not saying that because they really secretly intend to use again. Of course, sometimes they do if it's part of that other type of manipulation. But really what is the nature of addiction is it is a drive that has exceeded our prefrontal cortex, our executive, which is like the substrate of our cognitive executive. An addiction is just a drive that has exceeded the inhibitory control exerted by the executive, by our prefrontal cortex. It's no different than other drives. Like you have a drive for food, a drive for sex, a drive for companionship, a drive for, you know, anything you enjoy. If you like ham sandwiches, you got a drive for ham sandwiches. But things that aren't what I would call unnaturally rewarding, as the things that people get addicted to are, they don't result in people having drives that fundamentally can't be inhibited by the prefrontal cortex. And the sort of the working definition that I use for what addiction is, it's just any behavior that has a drive associated with it that has become so strong that it has exceeded that person's ability, that person's prefrontal cortex's ability to reliably inhibit the drive. So what that means is that when it comes to things related to the behavior, the addictive behavior, the normal executive isn't actually the executive or the boss anymore in your brain. It's just your module that controls the drive for that thing. And unfortunately, those modules aren't sophisticated. Unlike your executive, you know, your executive, your prefrontal cortex, which is getting data from every other part of your brain and processing it as a whole, the parts of our brain that mediate our drives for specific things really only know about that one little thing. They're just a tiny little module. And they don't get input from other parts of the brain. And what that means is that, you know, if you're a cocaine addict and you think about cocaine, you get triggered about cocaine, things related to cocaine come up, and that part of your brain gets activated, and all that part of your brain really does is push the button, so to speak, to give you that drive to go get cocaine. In the case of an addict, that drive can't be inhibited or reliably inhibited by the prefrontal cortex, by the executive, and it only knows about that one thing in the world. It only knows about cocaine and go get it. And so what that means is that when that part isn't active and the person is really their whole selves, they can promise you they're never going to use cocaine again and really mean it. And then walk out of the room, see cocaine somewhere or think about cocaine, have that part of their brain activated. And then even though the part of them, which is the executive, the whole them, is saying, no, don't do it, don't do it. There's all these reasons not to do it. It loses that battle. And the new boss, the new executive, relative to cocaine, makes the decision to go and compels the person to go do it. And then they do it. And then the craving goes away and, you know, it's over. And then everybody's mad at the addict and says, oh my God, you're a manipulative asshole. How could you have possibly told me you were never going to use again? And then 15 minutes later, go out and use. And literally the addict is often asking themselves that exact same question. Like, how did I let myself use? So that I would say is the one thing that is probably most misunderstood about addicts, which is that in that way, they're not really being manipulative. This is just the part of their brain that's out of whack. It leads to behavior that from the outside looks incredibly manipulative. And were the person to not be an addict would in fact be incredibly manipulative.
I've heard you speak before about people making the claim that it's just not a good time for me to start recovery. I can't right now. The timing's terrible. You mentioned, I believe, that it was the first day of your second year of med school was your sobriety birthday or something around there. That sounds like a pretty inopportune time for a relapse and having to get sober. So I imagine you have a unique perspective when it comes to how a person's sense of timing plays into whether or not they go get help.
Yeah, that part of my personal history does sometimes come into play, you know, if you know, when I'm working with patients, when they, you know, if they say, look, it's really an inconvenient time, I can't go to treatment, I've got a job, I've got all this other stuff, because, you know, yes, I don't know that you could be in a less opportune situation to go to treatment other than your first day of your second year of med school, especially when my med school, of course, didn't know that I was an addict, you know, because I had been sober for 2 years when I applied to medical school or started medical school. And, you know, didn't disclose on my applications that was the case. But, you know, what happened was, you know, I initially got sober just through doing 12-step and really threw myself into it. And it worked. It kept me sober for 3 years. But I, you know, I have developmental trauma that I needed to do the type of work that, you know, 12-step doesn't heal post-traumatic stress disorder. 12-step doesn't heal bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder or other, you know, so I had other issues that weren't being adequately addressed, and you know, and I had stopped using, and so they were running. You know, the symptoms of those conditions were intense, and I ended up relapsing. Actually, the first time at the end of my first year of medical school, and I had a 4 little binging relapses. You know, just what we call chipping. So it was just just a couple days each, separated by a month or two, a couple months. The last relapse was, again, it was my first day of my second year of med school. And, you know, interestingly, this is maybe more detailed than I should go into, but whatever, you know, I was a cocaine and an opioid addict. And my wife at the time was able to tell when I was using cocaine, because I would have bruxism, which is when you grind your teeth. So I was able to conceal heroin use much more easily. And on all of my previous little relapses, I had used heroin and cocaine together right from the beginning. But this time, because of the circumstances and I didn't want her to know, I just, I opted to just use heroin. And in retrospect, you know, I think the fact that I had been using cocaine concurrently with the heroin actually prevented me from overdosing on the heroin in those previous relapses. And so this time I had a very severe overdose. You know, my wife found me in the morning. I was cyanotic, which means I was totally blue. She couldn't wake me up. Had to do, called 911, had to do chest compressions on me. They came and gave me Narcan, and apparently I woke up just for a minute, but I had been, I developed something called acute respiratory distress syndrome. So I had multi-system organ failure. I ended up being in the ICU for 5 days after that. And, you know, as scary as that was, and even now thinking about it in retrospect, it scares me. You know, the silver lining of that was it really put things in perspective for me. So yes, it was not a convenient time for me to go to treatment. And it couldn't have been more clear to me that I was going to die if I didn't really take the time to get do the work and get the treatment that I needed. So I ended up going to my med school and saying, listen, I actually found the woman who had interviewed me was the head of admissions. And I said, I made an appointment with her and I said, listen, you know, I'm a heroin addict. I was sober for 2 years when I applied. I just relapsed, and I'm going to be gone for the next 30 days because I need to go get treatment. And I don't know what you guys are going to do with me, if you're going to kick me out or what, but you know, that's what I need to do. And I, you know, and fortunately, the medical school was incredibly gracious, you know, and I've been sober since then. I was, you know, August 3rd will be 16 years. So
congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah.
Were there inflection points in your use before you got sober for the first time? Do you recall inflection points where things were progressing, things were getting worse, and some voice inside of you is like, hey, Jason, this is not getting any better. Did you note sort of like, this is progressing, but I'm not doing anything about it? Was there a consciousness to that, or was it more insidious in a way, the progression?
Oh, undoubtedly. I think most addicts have this experience. Initially, it is insidious, right? So nobody plans on becoming an addict when they first start using. And I think for most of us that end up developing addiction and then end up getting clean, and you know, I think that there is a point where you recognize, oh wow, this is getting out of control. And then, you know, you try to moderate and fail. I mean, that essentially is from a empirical perspective, that's the behavior that you sets the core feature of addiction. It's the inability to moderate your use. And I do think that for pretty much everyone who becomes an addict, they need to prove to themselves that they have in fact lost their ability to moderate, right? Nobody, by definition, we become addicted to the things that we enjoy doing and we get pleasure from. And so I don't know anybody who's ever gotten sober who was still had the core belief that they would actually be able to manage it, to be able to moderate their behavior. So there was for me actually a pretty protracted period of probably about a year where I had recognized, oh man, I really think I'm an addict and I need to stop, and would stop and then relapse and then stop and then relapse. And, you know, when you're an opioid addict, that's hell, because, you know, I was constantly yo-yoing back and forth between using and then being in bad withdrawal.
You just brought up developmental trauma, and it was something you said about developmental trauma that helped me understand and appreciate developmental trauma from, say, trauma writ large. And there's some pretty significant differences between developmental trauma and perhaps, I don't know what the appropriate term would be for the rest of trauma, but I suppose you could expand on that with a little more articulation than I could. So what is developmental trauma and how does it differentiate?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. It's a really good question. So to start off with, we use the term trauma in mental health care very liberally, and we use it to mean a larger set. Its denotation is definitely quite broader than its denotation in sort of just common language. So in common language, trauma means usually combat trauma or rape or witnessing a murder or being beaten. And those things are all absolutely trauma. The term that's sometimes used in mental health care for those types of traumas are shock traumas or big T traumas or acute traumas. Trauma in mental health care can also mean in things that may not have ever at any particular moment risen to the level of those big T or acute traumas, but may have existed chronically. You know, there's sort of an area under the curve way of looking at this, right? So meaning, you know, something, if the x-axis is the acuity of the distress or the intensity of the distress and the y-axis is time, you know, things that cause enormous amounts of stress but only last a short period of time, those are the things that, again, in common language we refer to as traumas. The area under the curve there may in fact actually be the same as things that maybe only caused a moderate level of distress but were there chronically, right? So one of the ways that I talk about trauma when I'm trying to explain it to patients in terms of developmental trauma is really, it's trauma is just any event or series of events that caused a level of emotional distress that exceeded your ability at the time to process those feelings. And this brings up a more nuanced point, which is, when we talk about trauma in mental health care, usually what we're talking about is the clinical phenomenon of the repercussions of a traumatic event. Meaning when we talk about trauma, we're not necessarily really saying the event itself. What we're talking about is the clinical condition, the trauma condition that exists as a consequence of the event or events. And, you know, one of the things that gets said through that lens is that, you know, it's not the event itself that's traumatic, or that leads to the clinical trauma. It is what's the context, what's the emotional and relational context that the event happens in. Emotions are like food. If we process them or metabolize them, they go away. And if we don't, they just kind of stay there forever. What we need to process an emotion is just to be able to feel it and express it in the context of support from an ally or series of allies, meaning in a loving, supported relationship. If we're angry and we get support in that anger and we feel like we've got relationships where we've got allies and they're like, yeah, you're right, you know, and that sucks that happens to you. And we can feel that feeling and express it and let it be out there and be supported in it. That metabolizes the feeling and it goes away. And conversely, if we don't have the opportunity to do that, it just kind of sticks with us, right? So the little thought experiment I kind of lead people down is, you know, you can imagine you get in a fight with somebody at work, you know, named Bob, and you come back and you tell your partner, man, can you believe this asshole Bob at work? Can you believe what he did, right? And it's like, you know, what do you want from your partner? What you want from your partner is for them to say, yeah, fuck that guy. Right? You want them Absolutely. To say, yeah, man, Bob's been riding you ever since you started that job. Man, I can't believe you have to put up with all of Bob's bullshit. And you're like, yeah, you know, and then you kind of get over it, and then you watch Netflix and you're over it, and then you don't have to go back to the work and yell at Bob or say do something with Bob you're gonna regret because you work with him, right? You got the support in your relationship and you metabolize the feeling. Now compare that scenario with a scenario where you get in a fight with Bob at work and you come home and you tell your partner, man, Bob's such an asshole. Can you believe this thing that Bob did to me at work today? And your partner says, well, I don't know. Did you think about it from Bob's perspective?
Yeah.
Right? And you're like, then that feeling gets stuck, right? You know, and the thing is, so what developmental trauma is really an accumulation of negative emotions, typically as a result of conflict, typically in conflict with people who are older than us, as well as children, that we never really got support in processing the feelings around. We never got to have somebody tell us, hey, that wasn't okay for that other person to do it, or just somebody to be on our side. So unfortunately, what tends to be the consequence of that is the development of a sense of self that is predominantly rooted in shame. You know, so guilt is feeling like you did something bad. Shame is feeling like you are something bad. And importantly, shame and anger are kind of the same emotion. They just have a different vector, right? So shame is anger turned inward, and anger is shame turned outward. And when there's a conflict between two people, they both experience negative emotion as a consequence of that conflict. The person in the dominant role, if there's a disparity in dominance between them, the person in the dominant role in the conflict feels anger towards the other person, and the person in the subordinate role typically feels shame. And given that most of our conflicts with important figures in our lives when we're kids are with people who are in dominant roles to us, you know, our parents, our teachers, you know, older kids, you know, we develop this accumulation of shame, and then we move out into the world as adults with this sense of self of shame, of being bad in some way. And that fundamentally, in my mind, is actually the core source of the chronic negative feelings, depression and anxiety, that some of us end up discovering awesome ways to numb out with drugs, right? But when you give up the drugs, now what you've got is this sense of self that's rooted in shame that now is generating chronic feelings of anxiety and depression, you know, in the absence of something sad or dangerous happening right now, right? Because it's that shame is about that sense of self developed related to things that happened when we were developing. And so now you're walking around with this sort of shame engine in you and no way to numb it out. And that loops back to what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, which is, you know, it's really important if you're going to stop using drugs, stop taking your emotional anesthetic, you got to actually heal the source of the pain that you were being numbed from. And healing the source of that pain really is about going and converting your shame-based sense of self into a healthy sense of self. And you do that through psychodynamic therapy, which is a little bit more complicated conversation, but you do that in psychodynamic therapy, going back to those original injuries and reprocessing them with the support and alliance from an ally that you didn't have at the time, and creating a new narrative about what happened where you're the protagonist as opposed to the person who is in a dominant role being the protagonist.
What's the complicated piece about psychodynamic therapy that just came to mind for you? What were you referring to when you said that, that it can be complicated?
Oh, actually, it was more or less what I just said after it, which was, I just meant, it's just a longer conversation, but we can talk about it now. I mean, basically, you know, it's so at my UCLA program, at the dual diagnosis program, that's a cognitive behavioral therapy program. Cognitive behavioral therapy is an amazing tool that helps you learn about the processes that are going on behind your addiction, your depression, your anxiety. It gives you tools to attenuate or turn down the intensity of those symptoms. It gives you skills. It's primarily what we would call a didactic or coaching almost based modality. The mechanism by which cognitive behavioral therapy works doesn't really rely in a core way on your relationship with the therapist, with the cognitive behavioral therapist. Like in fact, people can benefit from CBT just by reading about it in a book, you know. It's obviously better if you can do it with a therapist, but you can kind of think that your CBT therapist is an asshole and you can still benefit from it. And fundamentally it's because it's a process of learning. Psychodynamic therapy is a little different. And the limitations of cognitive behavioral therapy is more or less agnostic to what are the reasons why you keep having these feelings of depression and anxiety and these distorted thoughts that are behind them, right? CBT sort of doesn't address that piece. Psychodynamic therapy does. Psychodynamic therapy really gets at sort of actually changing your core sense of self. And psychodynamic therapy, the mechanism by which it works actually relies on the relationship with the therapist. And the reason is because, as I was saying 2 minutes ago, when you have these conflicts, when you're a kid with people who are in roles, dominant roles to you, you experience shame because the narrative of what happened is with the dominant person as the protagonist. That's how humans work. When we're in relationships, we create shared narratives. And, you know, when there's conflict, it's like a camera angle. It can only be, you know, when there's conflict, there's a good guy and a bad guy. And the protagonist is the good guy, and whoever is in conflict with the protagonist is the bad guy. And one of the things that you've, in a position of dominance, get to decide in a relationship is for that the narrative of what's happening in that conflict, who's the protagonist? Of course, the dominant person chooses themselves, and that's why the narrative is, that's why they feel anger. When there's a story and somebody's in conflict with the protagonist, you feel anger at the person in conflict with them. Well, for the person who is in the subordinate role in that narrative, which is you as a child, you are the bad guy in relation to the good guy of the person that you're in conflict with. And when you're watching a story as a third person, you feel anger towards the bad guy. When you are in the story and you are the bad guy, you feel shame. and that's the piece that needs to go back and get changed. And again, the way that gets changed is through deconstructing that narrative of what happened, reconstructing it with you as the protagonist, and then being able to process the feelings around that. And to do that, you need to do that in the context of a relationship with another person. That same reason I was saying, like when you come back from your argument with Bob and you talk to your partner, you know, you could write down like, or think in your head, I'm in the right here. Bob was wrong, and try to work out. But really, the way you work through that emotional process is you have an ally who says, yes, I'm aligned with you. And the thing that really makes our allies is they're with us right or wrong, right? You know, when my girlfriend gets in a fight with somebody and wants to talk to me about it and is upset about it, you know, what she wants and what she needs from me isn't a dispassionate judgment about who was right and who was wrong in her argument with that other person. She wants somebody who's an ally, who she knows is with her and on her side no matter what, you know. And that's that relational piece that you need in order to get rid of the old narrative from your childhood where you were the antagonist and replace them with narratives where you are the protagonist.
So that's, I think, a very helpful distinction between psychodynamic therapy and perhaps cognitive behavioral therapy, amongst other modalities. What role does medication play in all this? And of course, everyone's different, but broadly speaking, and you know, however you want to take it, what role does medication play?
Sure. So medication is, so it's difficult to talk about medication really broadly because it really depends on what the medication is and what it's being used for. If you're talking about depression and anxiety, then, you know, the medications that are used for that, which, you know, the sort of first line treatments for that are what are called the SSRIs or SNRIs. Now we're getting fancier drugs, but that's the broad category. And they work pretty well. They can definitely help attenuate or turn down the intensity of the symptoms. They can reduce sort of the looping or obsessional thinking. They don't work great. And particularly for people with addiction, they find that they don't work great because if they did work great, they would be addictive themselves, right? So meaning the key thing with medications that are usable by psychiatrists is they have to work, but they can't work too well because if they totally numbed you out from your feelings, then you would run into the same problems with them that you run into with heroin and alcohol and marijuana and cocaine and the other things that really, really work. Now, if you're talking about bipolar disorder, that's really something different. So bipolar disorder really is more, I think of more as like a neurologic condition. And that, you know, is a condition where the medications that you take from that help protect against having mood episodes, manic episodes, or bipolar depressive episodes. Now, if you're talking about the medications that are used for addiction specifically, you know, you have medications like buprenorphine, which are, it's the sort of the active medication in Suboxone. It's used for opioid use disorder. You know, that works fundamentally very differently. That replaces, that's an opioid replacement treatment. So in that case, you're actually giving opioid addicts an opioid. And it's a much better opioid for them to be on than heroin or oxycodone or whatever, because it has a very long half-life. And also it's what's called a partial agonist, which means that it is somewhat less euphoric. And it is very difficult to overdose on unless you mix it with another class of medications. So people have much better quality of lives on Suboxone than they do on heroin. They're able to lead functional, normal lives. And, you know, one of the drawbacks to Suboxone is because it's an opioid, it does sort of have that same numbing characteristic that other opioids do. And it I think, to some degree, makes it more difficult for people to really do the psychotherapeutic work to heal the underlying cause of what it was that was, you know, initially led to their addiction. And then they get kind of, you know, then if they ever want to come off of the Suboxone, then they typically are sort of back where they started when they went on it. So, and yet it's also, you know, a huge improvement. It's life-saving when you've got somebody who's actively using opioids like heroin or oxycodone.
So as you said in the beginning, it's a hard thing to generalize because the individual reasons people would need one or another medication are, there's just a gamut. That seems to be with the pain podcast that Bloodstream Media recently did, that was something that became very clear, was just how individualistic, now I'm talking about pain more broadly, but how individualistic pain and the treatment of pain ultimately needs to be. I am conscious of our time, so I want to see if I can sneak in one specific thing I'd love to hear you speak to, and then maybe a wrap-up question here. But most people listening to this, I would imagine, appreciate that there is a relationship between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. That seems relatively logical. But there, I don't know if the nature of how those things are related in the context of a conversation about addiction and a co-occurring disorder, I don't know if people appreciate just how connected those things are. Could you speak to the connection between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors?
Sure. So the connection between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors is the core insight that is the foundation of cognitive behavioral therapy. And as you said, yes, I don't think it's surprising to anyone to hear that there is a connection between their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. But explicating what those connections are is very helpful in, and using that as a framework is very helpful in helping people recover from mental health and addiction conditions. So for example, it's probably not surprising to anybody. I mean, in fact, when you say it, it sounds self-evident that, you know, what you think, the thoughts that you have, determine the emotions that you feel. So, you know, if you interpret something as dangerous, you're going to feel anxious. But if you look at that exact same scene and interpret it as not dangerous, you're not going to feel anxious, right? Right. So meaning if you think that there's a tiger in the room next to you that's about to attack you, you're going to be really anxious. And then if you realize, oh, wait, that wasn't really a tiger, that's just a picture of a tiger that somebody happened to put next to me, you're like, oh, okay, I'm not anxious anymore. Nothing changed out in the world. You just had different interpretation, different cognitions or thoughts. And our thoughts feed into our sort of emotion machine, and it generates the emotions that we feel. So as I said, I think that when you explain that to people, it's sort of self-evident. But what is really useful about having that understanding is that it helps you sort of become aware of and change the dysfunctional patterns of and connections of between your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors in certain conditions like depression, anxiety, and addiction. So, for example, hallmark characteristic of a depressive disorder is having distorted cognitions. People who are depressed always engage in things like all or nothing thinking, right? So everyone hates me.
Right.
Nothing I do ever works out. You know, and then of course, if you think that and it worked and you believe it to be true, oh my God, what a terrible thing, right? And so, you know, the work of cognitive behavioral therapy is unpacking that and then trying to be scientific about whether those things are actually true. Well, is it really true that everyone hates you? It's like, well, no, actually, it's true that maybe, you know, Bob hates you. But, you know, here are four people who love you.
You might need a new job. I don't think it's just working out with this Bob guy. It seems like he's the source of a lot of problems here.
Exactly. So, you know, and if you think, and then you replace the distorted cognition with the more accurate one, like, some people don't like me. Lots of people do like me. Well, the emotions from that are usually a lot more tolerable than the emotions of everybody hates me. And it's the same with anxiety, right? So, you know, panic disorder involves distorted cognitions related to body sensations, right? So it inherently at the core of panic disorder is a misinterpretation of a bodily sensation as being evidence that you are either going to lose control, go crazy, or die. Right? So if you believe that this feeling you're having in your body is evidence that you are about to lose control, go crazy or die, of course, that is an incredibly anxiety. If you believe you're about to lose control, go crazy or die, you know, you're going to feel more anxious, which then unfortunately intensifies that very feeling. And it creates this positive feedback loop that is the core of panic disorder. So that's the way in which cognitive behavioral therapy really, and with addiction, it really is about understanding that, you know, if you have a cognition or a thought that is about the behavior or substance you're addicted to, you know, it's like, you know, you have an addictions or a cravings factory in your brain, and it's like a conveyor belt, and your thoughts just go by it on the conveyor belt. And if they're not about the thing you're addicted to, nothing happens. But as soon as you have a thought about the thing that you have an addiction to, it, you know, the little homunculus in there presses a button, and it creates the symptoms of craving. And then one of those symptoms is an intensification of your thoughts and a focusing of your thoughts on that very thing, which then of course create more thoughts about it to get fed back into the cravings factory. And then that becomes a positive feedback loop. Being able to understand that gives us an ability to understand things we can do to avoid that from happening. Like avoiding what's the reason you avoid your triggers when you are in early recovery, right? And it's also where you can make use of mindfulness as a way to not get into these downwards or these loops where you start arguing with yourself about whether you should or shouldn't use, because that only puts more gasoline on that fire. And those are all things where if you have that understanding about the connection between thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, you're able to understand this process that otherwise is just kind of happening in the dark.
Right.
And then thus have more control over it.
So before I let you go, is there one thing that you could share with people who are listening who maybe there's things they're hearing that that are really resonating? Maybe there's people who are like, you know, I should really take some steps to take a look at this thing. Is there a particular place you'd recommend people start, or a particular question or series of questions people ask themselves if they are wondering, do I struggle with an anxiety or depressive disorder and addiction? Is this something that applies to me? What could people's next step be?
Well, it's always a good idea to reach out for help because, and people tend not to do that. So the data about, for example, with anxiety disorders between onset of symptoms and first and diagnosis or presentation for treatment, for OCD, which is an anxiety disorder, I think the average is like 12 years. It's crazy. So people tend not to ask for help for multiple reasons. You know, one is there's shame, there's stigma associated with it. The other is people just don't know how to ask for help. But absolutely reaching out to a therapist, and you can ask your primary care doctor for a referral to a psychiatrist, is a great way to go. You know, you can go onto Psychology Today and look, you know, see different therapists that are on there, but you know, it's an unregulated forum. So, you know, it's sort of buyer beware. You know, people of course can always call the UCLA Dual Diagnosis Program. You know, I run another program called the Camden Center, which is sort of a broader spectrum mental health treatment center and addiction treatment center. And, you know, at least with those two programs, and I can't say that this is the case for every program, you know, we provide recommendations for, we do it, you know, at least an over the phone assessment, and then provide recommendations if we're not going to be a good fit for what will be a good fit. And that really is, I think, unfortunately, one of the things that is a bad part of the way that our current mental health care system is, which is it's very hard for people to know how to access adequate resources. You know, unfortunately, if you go online and you just look at treatment centers or you look at therapists, you know, they often are trying to sell you on coming to them. and so it's not really a dispassionate or, you know, an unbiased thing. And so it's difficult, you know. One of the things we do with the UCLA Dual Diagnosis Program is we, you know, many people who come in for an assessment aren't appropriate for that level of care, and we will work with them to find appropriate referrals. So we do the same thing at the Camden Center. You know, if people call in and they're not appropriate for us, we will work with them to find appropriate referrals, which is really, I mean, that's unfortunate. That's how it should be. It should be that, it, you know, no matter where you go, it should be like, oh, well, if we're not the right fit for you, this is why, and this is what we would recommend. Unfortunately, though, it can be a difficult system to navigate. But reaching out for help is absolutely, under all circumstances, better than not.
And if you don't know where to reach out for help, or you want more information about the two programs Dr. Schiffman's been speaking about, the Dual Diagnosis Program at UCLA and the Camden Center, we'll have links in the program notes so you can click those, read on, contact if you're inclined to. Dr. Schiffman, thank you very much. You have a way of making this stuff, which can, for me anyway, feel very complex and difficult and far away, human and relatable and digestible.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on. It's really been a pleasure.
Excellent. Take care, Dr. Schiffman.
This episode of Bloodstream is brought to you by Takeda. And like always, we are very, very grateful of Takeda's support of this podcast and continued support of getting...
Oh, look at this. They want to give me cookies.
What?
I just went to bleedingdisorders.com and they say, please accept our cookies. Takeda's trying to give me cookies.
Are they going to like mail them? Like a cookie subscription?
Oh, it's a website cookie.
Oh, those are the only kind of cookies I don't like.
Same, but I guess...
I thought it meant like tagalongs or Thin Mints.
Nah,
That's just the Girl Scouts.
Nah, this is the Google Chrome version.
We can thank the Girl Scouts for cookies and Takeda for the sponsorship.
Thanks, Girl Scouts and Takeda. Again, I want to thank Dr. Jason Schiffman for coming on and sharing his expertise and his time with me and with you here at the Bloodstream Podcast. I have a lot of respect for that man, and I hope you now know why. And that, Natalie, I'm sad to say, are you ready?
Is all for this episode?
It is. There are special thanks to give to everyone at Believe Limited, our presenting sponsor Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, our like segment sponsor Genentech. Check out their community Facebook page. Thanks as well to Dr. Jason Schiffman for participating as today's interview guest. Did you know you can subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts? Did you know that you can leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts store? Did you know that you can tell a friend about us, and that word of mouth is truly the best way to introduce new people to the show? Email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch. And until next time, take self-care of yourself and someone else, too. Bye, everybody.